Hi and welcome. This is Dave. I hope you're all doing great. Let's spend a few minutes with any questions or comments or things that you would like to discuss from what we've talked about so far. Has everything made sense? Does it seem applicable to you? Or are there things you'd like to discuss further or clarify from anything we've talked about? I'm looking at the questions that a number of you sent in, and I think the ones that relate to how can clients achieve a new state of mind, how can we help someone regulate a state of mind, we talked about last time. We're going to spend this seminar and the one after this talking about how to practically go about helping someone create change. We're going to talk specifically in this seminar about 10 principles of how the brain works to facilitate change and 6 elements to map change. And then we're going to talk about a system, the roadmap system, in our last seminar about how to really effectively work with someone to put this into effect. So anything else that you would like to talk about? This is a benefit of doing it live and having it, at least in the beginning and the end, sort of resemble a seminar that we can have interaction. And I'm very eager to hear what you think and how you're hearing all this. Does it seem helpful to you in working with clients? Anyone? Well, if there aren't any questions, I'll move directly into the material. Last chance for discussion or questions. And again, if any come up in between times even, or during the seminar, we're going to have some time at the end to have discussion and to have exchange at the end. So I'm going to put us on lecture mode and then we'll come back. To look at mindset mapping for growth, first let's look at the whole concept of mindset and see how it can be useful to us as coaches. Recall from last seminar, a state of mind is like a software program that determines what we perceive and then how we process information as well as how we respond. Our minds constantly monitor and interpret to give us a running account of what's happening, what it means, and what to do. And this is how we stay on track or how we get stuck. Now, mindsets frame the ongoing account of how we do this. They're powerful beliefs of the stories about ourselves and about our world. Researchers at Norwegian University of Science and Technology recently demonstrated that the brain creates multiple independent maps while finding its way in the physical world. The brain, in other words, operates like a Google map. Rather than one big continuous map, the brain makes a whole series of maps to operate, and a stimulus or a cue boots up a particular map for that situation. So when a new situation arises, the map that we fit to that, which our brain automatically fits to that, is booted up. So this is how, and this explains how we have different contexts or frames for different situations. And globally, this means that we have different states of mind and mindsets. These mindsets or maps are stored in the hippocampus, the brain's memory focal point. A mindset is its own world, its own software program, complete and internally consistent. So when we're working with a client, we often look at strategy or story first. But the important thing, remember from what we talked last time, state always comes first. State of mind determines the meaning you attach to any cue or stimulus, and the meaning determines your behavior. So to change your behavior, you need to change the meaning you attach. And that can most effectively be done by getting in a centered state of mind so that you perceive it in a way that you have the full range of possibilities. There's also in my blog archives, there is a blog that really simplifies this process called The Neuroscience of Change, 3 Steps to Rewire Your Brain. And I'd refer you to that. It's in the archived list of titles at the right at the blog site, mentorpath.com/blog, or just go to MentorPath and hit the tab at the top for blog. Let's talk a little bit about the brain story, which is to say mind maps. The brain connections, or mind maps, influence the reality that we see. The mind map is our brain's story. A paradigm, roughly synonymous with a mind map, is a model. It's a theory or a frame of reference. It's simply the way we see the world. What we perceive, understand, and interpret is our individual paradigm, our map. The paradigm is the map that explains the territory. It's not the territory itself. So with the right map, planning and strategy can make a significant difference. Now, each of us has a number of maps or paradigms in our head, our storylines. We're often unaware of having them, assuming that we see things the way they are. These paradigms, how we see things, then determine how we structure meaning and how we think and behave. So this is why it's helpful to be curious at times with our clients about this. If they're perceiving, if they're processing something, if they're attaching or attributing something that is not obvious, then we want to ask more about, well, how do you know that that's true? Or what do you really think is the basis of this? That's how we get at beliefs. Then beliefs determine how we're going to attach a mindset to it. Now, we originally construct beliefs to make sense of our experiences in the world. The beliefs then become predictors and confirm the reality that generates them. So if we're using a mindset that was part of a software program that was made some time ago, it could be outdated, or it could simply not work for the particular application right now. This is how we have to listen carefully to what our clients are saying. And listen to this story about how a belief becomes a predictor and confirms reality. It's a true story a number of years ago out of Oxford. 2 anthropologists were chosen to enter separate, essentially identical ape colonies to live and observe for a year. They were chosen, the 2 anthropologists, because they had remarkable similarities of personality, philosophy, training, education. The 2 anthropologists then lived in the ape colonies, not communicating with each other, not knowing what was going on, and stayed for a year. When they emerged to compare notes, they expected essential similarities, but instead found remarkable discrepancies. One anthropologist, after an initial period of transition, was accepted by the apes. He was integrated into the colony, achieved a real unity and harmony, a complete comfort with the apes. The other anthropologist never got beyond the social periphery of his colony, remained careful and vigilant, always seemed right on the cusp of a conflict, never achieved any harmony. Well, the anthropologist could not understand the wildly discrepant results or find any reasons. They and their teams puzzled for months until they finally found one difference. The anthropologist, who was the uncomfortable, careful outsider, carried a gun. Now, his gun never showed. He never used it. The apes never knew he had it. But he knew he had it. He knew if things got difficult, he had an out. The anthropologist, who had no gun, had instead a belief and a commitment. He knew from the beginning that he would make it on his own. In retrospect and reconstruction, each of their assumptions created the reality that they experienced. We tell our story, then our story tells us. As I mentioned, a belief is a feeling of certainty about what something means. To get someone's belief, simply ask, well, how do you know? As coaches, we listen for limiting beliefs, or beliefs that can ghostwrite behaviors that simply don't work. A map reduces the size and complexity of a territory. With this understanding, we can be effective in taking action. Rather than each situation feeling possibly overwhelming or chaotic or just a new experience, our attention shifts to this organizing frame of reference, the mind map. We help a client choose the most effective mind map. We relate it to something we know, which immediately suggests certain action options, or something which the client knows, of course. A danger is that we place the new into the container of the old, which could prevent new learning. One of our uniquely human qualities is self-awareness, the ability to reflect on how we think and what we do. In fact, the most recent Harvard Business Review has an article about the essential quality of self-reflection and how that the researchers in the article believe is the most essential quality of executives, the ability to self-reflect. Having this ability, we can learn from both our own experiences and from those of others. And of course, this is what we help our clients do. We help them develop empathy with themselves, a capacity to reflect on themselves, what they're doing, the effectiveness, to develop a mindfulness, to think about how they think about things and how they feel about things. This is why we can create a new story. We are not our old story. We created our old story. We are not our habits or our thoughts. We can think about these things and reflect on them. We can examine our paradigms to see if they serve us well. A dilemma simply can be having two or more mental maps in conflict. The work of coaching involves two levels of listening at least. One at a macroscopic level, helping to select the mental map that's most productive for a given task, or developing together a meta map. An example, someone feels anxious and uncomfortable about trying something new about the process of change. We can help them correctly read the anxiety or the uncertainty of a new endeavor as validation of moving ahead beyond a comfort zone, as indication of being in new territory, and the trepidation, the anxiety of not knowing exactly what the result is going to be, rather than the mind map that they may be using of an old model that means anxiety equals danger, better head for cover, or seeing the inevitable, ubiquitous discomfort of change, of doing something new, and reading that as intuition telling that this isn't the right thing. It's a good read of the awareness of the discomfort, but the wrong mindset, that it doesn't mean intuition is telling you the wrong thing. It means your error detection mechanism and your comfort zone movement is telling you that this is different. And you have to stick with the difference until you get comfortable with it. At a microscopic level, awareness of the choices of this moment in order to pick the best one. An example, if you label something wrong, you're going to write the wrong story. You'll use the wrong map. If you feel, for example, if you feel bad by saying no to someone and label the feeling as guilt, you'll use a different map than if you see no as setting an appropriate boundary. No means no. It means you're prioritizing things, and this is not something you choose right now, and you're taking care of yourself. Two very different maps. Here's another example of a conflicting mindset. A client of mine, an attorney, was asked by her dad, "I want you to be the executor of my estate." His daughter, my client, said, "Well, sure, Dad. First, I'll need to know some basic things about your property and your wishes." And he said, "Well, that's none of your business." Slightly conflicting mindset. Remember that the map is not the territory. That is, beliefs are not reality, at least not consensual reality. Beliefs are the negotiations we construct to deal with the subjective realities that we each experience. They're predictors. So we need to recognize that we each create our own stories, to take ownership of the stories in order to assess what needs to change, what needs to be enhanced, or simply what needs to be ignored. Now, to map a new story and navigate with the brain's error detection mechanism. Remember, we talked about using it as part of a strategy. Our brain creates patterns of connections in our ongoing search for meanings. These patterns, these mental maps, relate to our ability to plan and predict the future. Discomfort and uncertainty begin any significant journey. Our brains have an error detection mechanism located very close to the emotional center that says, when we try something new, this isn't normal. When our predictions get confirmed repeatedly, these patterns become hardwired and automatic. Then it's what we expect, and we happen to notice if something doesn't fit that predicted pattern. So the brain reads tilt, that this is an error, that this is not what is predicted. The error detection mechanism in the brain functions to compare input with the patterns that have laid down about what's expected. A mismatch creates a disruption in the expected order of things. So it's activating. Whenever the error detection mechanism gets activated, this creates a kind of response, and it can explain a number of dynamics. Some examples. We notice differences more easily than confirmation, so it becomes easier to focus on the things we do wrong and struggle to list our strengths. If advice is unfamiliar or unwanted, it sets off an error detection mechanism and a response, meaning that someone can reject an idea before consideration and place another barrier to resist change, which is why telling a client what to do may trigger the error detection mechanism if it's something the client's never thought of. You expect, of course, it's going to be an aha, but it could be, oh, that ain't right. And we have to know the client to know where to go on that one. Another example, to focus on problems energizes because it activates the error detection mechanism. This is the most common addiction that we all have as human beings, to problems. It's so much easier to focus on problems. That also activates our error detection mechanism. Think about you're driving down the freeway and traffic begins to slow. Everybody is rubbernecking. They're looking at the accident. They're looking at what went wrong. This is stimulation because it's something different than the usually boring drive unless you're listening to a really good talking book. The mental maps that were tailor-made for certain contexts in our lives, such as stress or in childhood, just may not apply in a situation now. The hardwiring is not permanent, though, and it can be revised. When change occurs in a systematic and consistent way, such as with collaborative, contingent conversations, which is exactly what we do as coaches, new connections are made in the brain. New maps are created. So the brain's error detection mechanism can be used as part of a powerful internal navigation system. So let's talk about 10 principles of how the brain operates to facilitate change. Each of these, I believe, are important and will be important to you in helping your clients understand how to create change that will last. First principle, change generates discomfort. This is really to inform your listening. Part of the reason for this resistance to change is due to a fact far more challenging than just getting somebody to decide to do things differently. Any attempt to modify behavior and habits requires an actual rewiring of the brain. First a disruption and then a rewiring. Activities that we've repeated that have become habits become hardwired into the brain. Neuronal pathways and neural networks, the highways and villages in our brain, have become etched by repeated habits to make efficient operation, to make routine behaviors easy. We don't have to think about how to drive the same way to work each day because of this default mode We can think about other things or listen to a book. This default mode is energy efficient because the brain's freed up to do other things. Now, when these habits are confronted and have to change, the automatic pilots in the midbrain get disrupted. We feel discomfort. The prefrontal cortex, the thinking brain, has to get busy with more energy and attention to process this thinking. Imagine, like, the usual way you go to work, suddenly there's construction, you have to snake your way through a neighborhood. It takes a lot of energy. You have to think about it. You really lose attention to the book you're listening to. It's work to change. The natural inclination is to resist the stress of change and to preserve the default habit. The brain naturally resists change. It's hardwired to save energy. So it opposes what's been adaptive from an evolutionary sense. Now, there are some of your clients who will relish knowing something like this at times when it seems helpful to understand something. It's always helpful to you to know what's going on with the client when the client is resistant. It's not the client is trying to resist you or progress or success or to defeat you in some way. It's simply the client is showing you exactly what it's like to be him or her. If you take it at that as the communication, if the client is doing exactly the job description that he or she is meant to do, to show you what it's like to be him or to be her so that you can propose a different way of looking at it and a different way of proceeding. This is how we earn our money while things come alive in vivo in the process of the relationship. Now, the promise of change is to develop a new, better default mode. The brain just doesn't know that yet, so our minds have to lead the way. Some remarkable new research shows that consistently repeating new experiences even alters gene expression. Beliefs can turn genes on or can turn them off. Ray Kurzweil said, "Civilization advances by extending the number of important operations which we can perform without thinking about them." That's from his very intriguing book, "The Singularity is Near When Humans Transcend Biology." I'm sure most of you know this. His last name is Kurzweil. 2. Change creates dissonance. We see what we expect to see, what our radar has been coded for. In fact, when we don't see what we expect to see, the brain's error detection mechanism reads as if something's wrong. So, since this portion of our brain has the job description to recognize and correct errors, consider the emotional expense of a couple of things. A lie. The surface story is the constructed lie. The subliminal story is the recognition of the lie by the error detection mechanism. Then you have to deal with the dissonance. Triple work. Debt. The real expense of buying something you can't afford is that you have to pay more for it. Then the emotional expense, the dissonance in your brain, your error detection mechanism reads that you spent what you couldn't afford to buy. Then you have to pay the interest on the debt. Triple work. You can deceive others, even your own mind. But your brain always knows. Now, the good news, the neural machinery can both recognize and correct errors to optimize behavior. So we also respond to mistakes. This is great if we remember to discern what's a mistake or a neural response and printout to change itself. Now, we'll return to this in a few minutes when we talk about mapping change. 3. The brain is a prediction machine. If you have a pen, let me give you some numbers. 1, 2, 4, 5, 7, and 8. Now, what's missing? Usual answers are maybe 3 and 6, perhaps. Multiples of 3. Consider this. Nothing's missing. I gave you a complete list of 6 numbers. Everything that's there is there. What's missing, if you thought it was, is inside your head, informed by a pattern of expectation. Now, this is huge in writing a new story. Sometimes you have to outsmart your brain. When anything recurs two times in a row, the brain predicts a third repetition. A stock goes up two quarters in a row, so the brain predicts a third rise will follow. J. Paul Getty said that there are three key elements to getting rich. Get up early, work hard, find oil. You can see how brain prediction of a pattern is also the basis of many jokes and stories. Listing two things, then a third non sequitur. Setup, payoff. The human brain automatically imposes patterns and predictions on repeated events. This makes it a challenge to override both emotion and brain patterns to make wise and balanced decisions. 4. Behavioral reinforcements can backfire. Let's say you're the COO, Chief Operating Officer of a company, determining a policy about employees being on time. Which do you think will work better, threats or reinforcements? The answer, neither. Both will likely backfire. Studies show two things. Threats work short-term, but draw attention away from the work and back to the problem that created the behavior. And secondly, recognition for someone being on time actually raises anxiety and reinforces the neural patterns connected with lateness. Remember what we talked about in terms of quantum physics and the energy field of the brain. We get what we focus on, not what we want. And both of these seeming solutions focus on something negative. And it doesn't work to just reverse a negative and focus on that, because the unconscious reads the focus, not the positive or negative, but the focus. We assume people will receive information about change and use it to better themselves. Not so, says the brain. The error detection mechanism reads, this isn't right. And being told what to do results in an innate opposition. The brain's natural homeostasis says, avoid change. 5. Motivation is not essential. How many times have you heard in Coach the Coach, if you've trained at CTA or with your clients, I just need to get motivated to work out. I just need to get motivated to lose weight. Someone does not have to be motivated to do something. And someone may not generate motivation until setting a goal. An action can generate its own motivation. Many of the professional athletes and actors I've worked with get up in the morning, go to the gym. They aren't motivated to do it. They just do it. Sometime during the course of the workout, maybe late into it, they get motivated. Usually not, though. They just do what they know is the next thing in order to do what's next for them. Every day, when I'm in Houston, 6 days a week, early to mid-afternoon, I go work out. I am not motivated to work out. I do it because I know that's what I need to do. Occasionally, when I'm at my ranch and I run the fence line, occasionally I'm motivated, the first half at least, because I'm excited about getting outdoors and seeing the critters and seeing the woods and all that. But about the last half, I am not motivated. I just want to get done. You do not have to be motivated to do something. You do need two things. You need a plan and to stick to it. Motivation is not essential, but a plan and sticking to it are. An example, you don't have to be motivated to save for retirement. You can just set up an automatic payment or participation plan. An automatic plan that once a month, the first of the month, you take X amount of your checking account and put it in your retirement plan. You don't have to be motivated. You just need one time to make a good choice for that one. The quality of many future years will be affected by it. You don't have to decide every time, just once. 6, emotions change brain functioning. When emotions are triggered, the brain chemicals dopamine and adrenaline are released that prompt toward action and away from creativity and assessing knowledge. This is why self-talk can be very limited. Change your thoughts to change your behavior. That may work until emotion gets activated, and then it's off the chart. As soon as emotion is triggered, reason runs and logic leaves. In fact, one of the philosophers of the 21st century put this really simply. Everybody has a plan till they get punched in the mouth. Now, I didn't say great philosopher. It was Mike Tyson. When there's possibility of a reward, dopamine is released to produce an excited state in response to anticipating a reward. A risky stock investment, approaching a slot machine or blackjack table, about to buy something. This is how shopping can become an addiction, because there's excitement about what you're about to do. Anything that becomes addictive is first an excitement and a dopamine trigger at the anticipation of it. So here's what we know now. We thought for a long, long time, neuroscientists, psychologists, that the reward itself is this spike in dopamine. That somebody does something, they get a reward, it accentuates the possibility of it continuing and reinforces it. Wrong. It's the anticipation of reward. For example, when gamblers were studied, their excitement occurred as they approached the slot machine. Their increased brain firing and dopamine spike when their brains were studied, preceded ever touching the machine well before they were ever rewarded with the win. And that's why, well, research shows that the anticipation of reward can be more satisfying than actually receiving it, because attaining the goal shuts down the chemical engine of anticipation and the dopamine high that goes with it. So looking forward to the big win or the big purchase or the big trip can be even more exciting than really getting it. This can contribute to things like buyer's remorse or the almost ubiquitous experience that a long-awaited new purchase isn't as exciting as you anticipated. And think about how this also, I talked some about this in Art and Science of Coaching Professionals, how with many, I began to listen to a number of coaches that I was doing mentor coaching with and some of the coaches I was training, that their clients at about a month or two kind of reached a plateau. They were, they sort of lost their vim and vigor and zest for coaching. They would hit a plateau, and they would often say, well, you know, I think I've gotten a lot. This is, I think all I can get. I want to just, you know, take a pause here, do a hiatus in our work or suspend our work. What happens is that when someone moves from the excitement and the anticipation, all the hope and the excitement of the new discoveries in the beginning, and then moves to from the sprint system, the excitement of the sprint system, the adrenaline and dopamine, to the marathon system, which is the norepinephrine, things aren't as exciting, because you don't get as excited doing, you know, a marathon as you do a sprint. And this excitement is read as less than enthusiasm, or maybe that's all there is, or I just need to quit. So that's useful for us to sustain work with clients, to ladder that success, to ladder the goals and objectives, to explain this if it happens, to resonate empathically with it, and to continue and sustain the work that's needed. So we can come back to that if any of you have any questions. I think it's an important aspect of keeping clients and having the full measure of what's possible. 7, stimulation and performance. Stimulation, also known as a little bit of stress, enhances memory and learning. The things that excite us provide a little bit of stress short-term. Stress is not the right word, but kind of the excitement, the anticipation, enhance learning. The time window for this is up to 2 hours. Now, for longer periods of time, especially 4 hours or more, things can go the other direction. Learning capacity declines. This means with sustained stress, people make bad, emotionally charged decisions. The most important success strategy for our clients is exactly what I mentioned last seminar, the regulation of states of mind and management of emotion. 8, closure to novelty. Studies show that even highly accomplished people close themselves to novelty as they get older. Now, the major factor is usually not their age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing, such as been in a particular business. People who stay in one place and one position can get most entrenched. An example of where I see this resistance in coaching is family succession of business. The patriarch founder passes the company he began 32 years ago to his two children to own and manage. It's a challenge because everyone involved changes roles and relationships, and everything about that process of change is contrary to the way they've been doing things, how their minds and brains work, and trying out things that are new and different. Now, these last two principles, I think, are especially huge. 9, neurogenesis is the creation of new brain cells. Two things above all others create neurogenesis: an enriched environment and exercise. An enriched environment of intellectual and emotional stimulation creates more complex brain structure to co-create, stimulate thinking, challenge, story bust, exactly what we do in coaching. The hippocampus is the part of the brain especially connected with creativity and memory. Mice from an enriched environment have a 15% increase in their hippocampal cells and the number of hippocampal cells. What's your guess about how much exercise increases the number of cells in the hippocampus? Almost 100% increase. Now, another finding, let me mention too, this has been replicated in recent studies in humans, in non-invasive studies, in London taxicab drivers and University of Hamburg medical students. Around 15% increase with stimulating environment and almost 100% increase in those who exercise regularly of the hippocampus, primarily involved with creativity and memory. Now, a related finding, chronic stress impairs neurogenesis. The number of cells in the hippocampus goes the other direction. And the 10th, neuroplasticity simply means that the brain remodels itself. This has been called the scientific revolution of our time. A region of the brain that originally had one job can be trained to perform another. The brain can reassign job descriptions of neurons, rezoning and developing cortical real estate. So when we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains as well. Here's an example of this. Some NASA astronauts did a training operation in which they had headgear with a visual apparatus that gave an upside-down image. It would reverse everything for 24 hours a day. Up was down. Everything they saw was exactly reversed. They had to learn to adjust everything they did. They had to move very carefully and think through every move in order to make a correct or coordinated move. Then, about day 25, they noticed something remarkable. Their brains automatically made the adjustments. They didn't have to anymore. Their brains had developed new neural pathways. They had rewired. Now, another group of astronauts in the headgear were given a day off out of the helmet for 24 hours at day 15. When they put the headgear back on, it took them 25 days from that point on to make the adjustments. Notice the role of consistency in creating a new habit. The human brain creates patterns of connections in our ongoing search for meaning. These patterns, these mental maps, relate to our ability to plan and to predict the future. When our predictions get confirmed repeatedly, patterns become automatic, so we don't even have to think about them. The patterns become hardwired and automatic. And this is what we talked about, for example, with the use of the neural conditioning chart that we looked at last time. When someone takes a usual cue or trigger and recognizes, rather than reacting in a usual way or behavior, and instead gets centered, couples that with ideal behavior, when this is done enough, there's neural conditioning, neural rewiring. So let's finally look now at six elements for mapping change. There are six crucial elements to map change. So I want to talk about how to understand and incorporate each of the six. One, and it's number one for a reason, we've already talked about it, regulate states of mind. Remember, minds are like a software, states of mind are like a software program. They're a mind-body state that determines how we perceive and process information. A key element is to be aware of our different states of mind, to know which state works best for what purpose, and to know how to regulate a state of mind. When someone's in an emotional state, they're overbalanced toward right brain response, the feeling brain. In extreme stress, the emotional brain can even hijack the intellectual, logical brain and hold it hostage. So when you're in any state of upset or any state of stimulation, this can be from a huge success. The first order of business is to regulate feelings to restore a cool state, a balance of left and right brain. This is exactly what we talked about in using the neural conditioning chart. So with any kind of tilt, any kind of stimulation, really good or really bad, break the state of mind. Step away from the table, whether it's a conference table, a dinner table. Take a walk. Wash your hands and face with cold water. Breathe deeply. Take a time out. Even sleep on it. Let me think about that and get back to you is a decision. Whatever you need to do to call a time out to get centered and grounded to get to that ideal response. The brain equation for good decisions is right brain emotional plus left brain, logical and intellectual, equals a balanced decision. And this is also for review. Number two element to map changes, the power is in the focus. This is the neuroscience and quantum mechanics behind the law of attraction. Thoughts have a frequency, an energy field. Focus selects a frequency. All the channels of a radio or satellite TV are available, as we discussed. We choose the channel, the frequency we want, out of hundreds of possibilities. We each transmit and receive a frequency through our thoughts. And remember, focus is one of the two ways of getting grounded that we talked about last time, to have a phrase that we say to ourselves in a mantra, a cue, a phrase, and a physiology like deep breathing. This concept of the powers and the focus offers an explanation at a brain level for why a solution focus is more effective than a problem focus. The brain connections literally become mind maps and subsequently influence the reality that we see. So, in other words, you become what you think about. So put energy into what you want. Focus on possibilities instead of problems, desires instead of obstacles. To fight something is to engage it. You add energy to it. This is kind of like saying denial is just another form of engagement. You're engaging it. This creates resistance and enhances focus. But when you focus on what you don't want falls away. It's kind of like your lap when you get up to walk. Three, visualize changes. Basketball players at Ohio State University were divided into three groups to practice shooting free throws. One group, no practice for a month. This was the kind of the prototype study. You may have heard of it. There have been hundreds since, but this just illustrates the principle here. One group, no practice for a month. One group, 30 minutes of practice daily at free throws. One group, practice imagining shooting perfect free throws. Nothing but net for at least 5 minutes daily for 30 days. They were tested at the end of 30 days. First group, no practice, 0% improvement. Second group, actual practice, 30 minutes daily, 24% improvement. Third group, practice by visualization only, 23% improvement. Now, in subsequent studies, the visualization actually surpasses the actual practice because each time you can visualize the perfect shot and you don't have to miss a little bit, recalibrate, go back and forth. And notice even in this study, it was 5 minutes of visualization versus 30 minutes of practice each day. So, on brain imaging, the same sequence of firing occurs with visualization as when actually seeing something and when actually shooting. Both all of the motor neurons fire in the same way in the brain where they originate. So create a vision, an image of your goal, then look back to see the path to get there. Visualization crystallizes possibility into an articulated idea. The experience changes the brain. A vision can serve as guide and inspiration to design ways to realize it, to live into it. 4. Insight changes the brain. At the moment of insight, which is an aha experience, as we call it in coaching, is a complex new set of neural connections is made. At the moment of insight, the aha, three different parts of the brain light up on fMRI scans during this moment. This aha activates centers in the brain that vaults someone, releases chemicals, and vaults someone into a different state of mind that is more creative and synthetic and integrative. Now, consider when someone is given facts, information, a directive, or an order. Nothing happens. But as important as this insight-induced change is, the sustained attention and repetition is what hardwires it into the brain circuits. 5, take action. The world will not pay you for what you know. It will pay you for what you do. It rewards action. To analyze and plan are important, but payday comes with action. Winners develop a plan and set it into action. It may not be perfect, but they self-correct and keep moving forward organically, learning from their mistakes, revising, continuing to do things, and produce results. This may be why a group of the brightest people anywhere with all kinds of degrees can plan and figure something out and struggle to make it happen. I was on a board of directors like this one time. Meanwhile, the guy who almost finished the second semester of community college owns a bunch of real estate on the west side of town. And 6, transform identity. Remember we talked about how the most powerful force of the human psyche is to return to our identity so that if we do something different or have a behavior that's different than we normally do, if we don't correspondingly transform our identity, our model of who and what we are, we're going to return to the identity, and the behavior is going to fall off. It's going to be just something we did. A new experience or idea needs to be focused on consistently and frequently. This consistent attention stabilizes brain circuitry. The mindset of identity then incorporates the new experience and integrates it as part of an evolving self, as a component of one's identity, the internal model of who and what you are. Otherwise, it's not integrated and prone to be dismissed as a not me experience or attributed to luck or circumstance. This is why a vision needs to include the experience, the feeling of achieving it. When you inhabit the entire episode or experience, you make it part of your self-experience, which is also why, as we're working with someone in mentor coaching, it's helpful to help them incorporate the changes into the evolving sense of themselves as they see themselves to be by highlighting the changes by having them acknowledge and recognize, as we do perhaps first, that they're changing. You know, I hear how different this is for you to be doing it in that way. Think about a month ago. We couldn't have been having this conversation. To in some ways, highlight and underscore and validate the change and the evolving sense of who someone is and what they're doing, to comment on the process of their change, not just the content. So, I want to conclude with some specific principles to help clients change mind, brain, and behavior, or first, let's say behavior, then mind and brain. Begin where the client is. Help them learn more about what they already know. Highlight positive attributes, existing neuronal networks like natural talents, behaviors, and patterns to encourage their practice. Don't focus on mistakes. Focus will enhance neuronal etching, so it should be on useful habits, not mistakes. Correct mistaken couplings. Understand and build on existing networks. Let sleeping dogs and old unuseful networks lay. Encourage clients to develop their own metaphors and connections. Stories, analogies, and metaphors create maps. And this is one of the things we can do in working with individuals or in working with groups, to look at the evolving story and how the story is different and how something is a new story that someone's creating. The brain has an intrinsic desire to create novel connections. A moment of insight creates the release of dopamine, of adrenaline, and helps someone to want more of that insight, of that change, the excitement of learning. So this is what is in contradistinction to the initial error detection mechanism that says this isn't right. Once we create, once we stay with it and create something that's really novel or insightful, and as part of this reflection, come to new recognition, it's intrinsically enhancing, it's rewarding in itself. The client has to recognize and take ownership of experiences. Every aspect of the client's story is the client's story. Remember the University of Hertfordshire study. Every bite is a choice. Every bite is part of that story. When we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. So, and finally, give attention to a new experience or new way of doing things consistently and repetitively, like the NASA experience. Okay, we're in discussion mode now. I'm interested in your thoughts and questions and reflections and things that might be helpful to talk about further. And if I could get you to manage the background noise with a mute, star six if you don't have a headset, so that there's not an interruption. You may not be hearing it, but your receiver is picking it up. So questions or thoughts? One thing I wanted to mention about, in contradistinction to the NASA experience, that other kinds of behaviors that are more complex, behavior patterns, attachment patterns, they don't change as quickly. Like, it's not just like 28 days or 30 days or, in the NASA experience, 25 days. It's not just a brief period of time like that for more complex behavior patterns. But also, the good news for that is you revert back a single time, and it's not like you have to start back at square one like the guys who are out of headsets for a full day. It just means you revise, learn from it, and move ahead, and you continue. continually make progress that way for more complex behavior patterns, you don't have to start all over again. So the early recognition, remember we talked about in the neuroconditioning chart, the purpose of the first column is to recognize as quickly as possible, to cue your radar for what kind of specific things, highly specific things, are triggers that will create a state change to move you in that second column, and an automatic behavior that you're aware of way in, I mean, you're aware of it, but then you're aware that you're into a negative pattern way into it, instead to recognize it early on and as quickly as possible move to that third column, to move to a way of getting grounded, the way of restoring that balanced state, then to move to an ideal behavior. And the goal initially is you just do it a little bit sooner each time. You recognize it a little bit earlier. You know, it's kind of like, you know, the first time you go out to run, you can go 4 or 5 blocks, and you poop. The next time you can go 5 or 6, the next time 7 or 8. The idea is to recognize it earlier and earlier so that you can stop and move to an ideal response, which is creating the neuronal pathway and networks that you want to repeat and enter as quickly as possible so that ultimately they become automatic. And what was triggering is really diffused and you have a new neural association. Thoughts, questions?
Dave, this is in Dallas. Can you hear me?
Yes, I sure can. Welcome. Hey.
There's so much information that you are giving us. I think it's fabulous and wonderful. I need to take time to process it all. So I don't really have any questions about me specifically or the work that I do.
Yeah.
I'm very curious. This sounds like it would be, this kind of study and this kind of work sounds like it would be so perfect for people who have PTSD. Can you tell me about that? Do you think this is or could be very helpful for people that are suffering with that?
It has been. It has been a great deal, and I have converted my experience with that to a coaching framework in what I'm talking about, and especially the use of the neuroconditioning chart. I think it works for CEOs as well as it does for people with the case study that I didn't have time for last time was a CEO I was working with, as well as for people with PTSD, because PTSD simply means that there's a cue or a trigger that creates a state change, and somebody gets locked into that state and responds, and the usual therapies try to understand and do all the things within that state, but that's never going to work because they have to get back and get into a more ideal state, and the quicker you can do that in a method to get back into a state that's going to work is the thing that's going to work. So, yes, is the simple answer to that. I think it's huge for all clients. It's huge for me when I interact with my wife.
Right.
I mean, it's huge for CEOs when they interact with their colleagues, with people in the executive suite. It's you know, it's useful for you when you go and drive the freeway.
Yes, I've always heard that if you get bored or tired of the same old, and you want to stimulate your brain, drive to work a different way.
Uh-huh.
Go on Knight Street instead of taking the freeway or whatever. That
yeah.
makes brain, and it certainly follows suit with everything you've been telling us.
But see, that's the compelling thing about someone who is accustomed to getting triggered and getting into that stimulated response in a negative way, is it stimulating? Kind of like the error detection mechanism that stimulates in a not good way sometimes, because it's stimulating. That's how we can get addicted to any kind of behavior or substance or any process, because activation or stimulation is preferred over nothing. And that's the compelling nature of it. That's the addictive quality of it. And how people get addicted to changing their states of mind. So that's something that I think we can have a significant benefit in terms of working with with people in coaching.
Right.
Well, and I think you're very right about looking at it in a systematic way. That's what I do with the training that I just started last week with New Life Story Wellness coaches, to look at how to apply this to various stories, wellness stories, money stories, career, relationship, any number of ways, and to look at we spend several weeks on, or four of the 12 weeks, and looking at the roadmap system. We're going to get an overview of it next time. I think it's that important. I think it's that powerful. I think it's the most effective system that exists right now, but I'm a little biased. So thank you very much for that thought and question. I know we have to stop. Look forward to picking up. If there are any other questions or comments, send me an email, and I'll discuss it at the beginning of next time. So thanks very, very much. Bye now. Have a great rest of the week.